Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The pair of comedians on today's show used to really hate each other. Now they spend most nights making each other laugh.
The biggest insult now too, death threats, for some reason, they don't bother me, but what makes me laugh is the people that, like in our culture now, the worst thing you can say is unfollow. Like that's gonna hurt me, like unfollow. It's like, I used to play arenas. Millions of people have unfollowed me. You're really late to this. Todd Oakley Ware for Life 7.
In fact, now is a great time. We should say this right out of the gate. We're gonna talk for a while tonight. And if anything Bob or I says does sincerely offend you, we don't want you to feel that it's incumbent upon you to come up to us later and explain it to us. That's your secret.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was Bobcat Goldthwait and Dana Gould in their new documentary/comedy special, Joyride. These two could not have been more different when they first started performing stand-up in the early 1980s. As they explain on today's show, Dana was a tightly wound intellectual comic, while Bobcat was known for his outrageous, self-destructive character who would scream at the audience and once set fire to Jay Leno's Tonight Show set. But as they've aged, their styles have converged. And in Joyride, they perfectly complement each other both on stage and in the extended car ride scenes where they almost forget the camera is rolling behind them. I've been such a big fan of both of these guys for so long, so it was a thrill to have them join me for this week's show. This is a really fun conversation, including some hilarious digressions about Bobcat's 30-year beef with Jerry Seinfeld and Dana's favorite jokes he ever wrote for The Simpsons. So let's get into it. Here's me with Bobcat Goldthwait and Dana Gould.
There he is.
There he is.
I was just texting you, Grandpa.
You're
on
mute.
Can we just keep it this way where Dana's muted?
All right. This is exciting, guys, to have both of you here.
Bob, say something that would get you canceled.
I would like, it is very exciting to get both of us here. Something that would get me canceled.
Go on, just do it. Just do it.
I don't think I am canceled.
Are you cancelable? That's the question.
Yeah. Not really.
You have to be at a certain level to be canceled. I think you were canceled back in the day. Maybe that's
no. I think like you have to be a multimillionaire that's thrown off by when a marginalized group speaks up and complains about you.
Yeah.
So yes. I'm not a multimillionaire, and I tend to side with marginalized groups. So I don't think I am cancelable.
That's good to know. That's good. We'll get to all of the history there, but I want to start with this new documentary, which I just got to see and really, really enjoyed. I think it's kind of like a comedy nerd dream movie, just to see you guys hanging out and on stage and everything that goes into this tour that you did together. But I would kind of like to start with the documentary. How did this, was it a tour that became a documentary, or did you always want to make it into a movie, or how did it all come together?
Yeah, it was all organic. It was Dana and I, like together, we can sell tickets at a rock club, comedy clubs, although I do make my living going out to them. A lot of them are, it's not pretty, you know. I always say I make a living so I can make movies. I don't make a living making my movies. But So this, we started doing this show. We would go on at different times. One of us we'd come out and flip a coin to see who was going to headline for the evening. And then what we realized that time when we went out and flipped a coin, people seemed to be enjoying that show a lot more than our individual shows. So we just jettison that part of the show and then just would stay out on stage together for the whole time. And the first time we did it, it was a lot of fun for us and I think the audience too. So then the idea of shooting it came up. And if it hadn't been for the pandemic, it would have been a more straightforward stand-up show. But it allowed me and the editors time to make a documentary. And I rolled cameras on us hanging out, but on purpose, I put the cameras behind us in the car.
In the car, yeah.
Yeah, because I wanted it. I didn't want Dana and I performing for the cameras. And subconsciously, we probably always knew they were there. We definitely did talk more the way we really did talk, and we weren't on.
That's interesting.
In that regard, the comedy viewer is really the pandemic's final victim.
Because now every comedy special is a documentary.
Is that true? I don't really watch them. Are they?
No, there are a lot of them, but
if this catches on, because it's really, I mean, it's Bob's movie. I'm in it, but Bob made it, and it's great. And I say that, you know, I'm in it. And it's, if you look at my filmography, there's not a lot of great movies that I'm in. No, and I, you know, I hate watching myself. And I was really impressed. It has a story. In addition to a lot of funny stand-up that we're both very good at what we do. And, you know, at this point in our careers, it would be really tragic if we weren't. Bob makes his living as a director. I make my other living as a writer. So I can construct the story on the page and give it to the filmmaker. Bob had the film already and had to construct the story post-fact. And I was really, really, really impressed with what he did. And that he had the selflessness to make himself the villain.
Yeah, to make myself the I have to, you know, I don't think I've ever told Dana this, but when you said that thing where it starts, where you said, we didn't like each other when we met, and I said, no, I hated you. And Dana's like, well, I hated me. I go, so we had that in common. I kind of knew, honestly, at that point, I go, we might have an arc here if we start with that. But then, as this sounds really pretentious, but as a storyteller, I knew that, so you have to apologize at some point on camera in order to give this thing an arc.
I love that as the premise that you used to hate each other and now you're up on stage together every night. This is a great concept, but I wondered how much truth is there in the fact that you used to have this antagonistic relationship when you were much younger.
Yeah, it's
all true.
Yeah, I was very vicious to him. I was very cruel, and I was happy when we found that footage where I'm kind of outroing him, and his parents are there, and I'm saying it's not pretty, and I'm like, oh, Dana, do that bit about women having stinky pussies, which I don't know why I say it. It's just bad. It's ugly.
Dana's here, and his folks are here, and he thinks that he has to do the right amount of time, and I wasn't gonna bust his balls. Come on out here and do that bit you do about women having stinky pussies here. Do the stinky pussy bit, will ya? Mom and Dad want to hear your stinky pussy bit. They would love to hear the stinky pussy bit.
That gives you a small inkling of how vicious I was to him. So it was interesting because I never saw this movie. Like normally when I make a movie, I get a handful of friends together and I get to watch it and see what's working, what's not. And in this movie, there was the only time I saw it with an audience or anyone was when it played the Moon Tower Comedy Festival. And it was interesting to me was after that point, I couldn't buy a laugh for the next 7 minutes. Like people don't like me in the theater after that. And I was like, I guess it's good. It works.
But then you got to dig yourself out.
But I was sitting there going, but are they going to come back? You know, are they ever going to like me again? So hopefully it seems like they do.
They do.
It was interesting.
Very likable.
But we were in the comedy festival and I'm like, well, you know, Jerry Seinfeld's a god. And I was like, how's that going to play?
Yeah, right.
You know? And I was relieved when they burst into applause when I said, Jerry Seinfeld finally has an opinion and it's about me. And I was really happy to hear comedy nerds laughing at that.
Hot dog buns and Bobcat Goldthwait, the two things that get his goat.
Lost socks in the dryer and Bob Scratch Goldfarb.
I do love that you included your beef with Jerry Seinfeld, which I think is something that we talked about, Bobcat, when we met the last time.
But the funny thing to me is that I made a decision, and this didn't make the doc. There was some stuff where I made a decision to no longer do the persona that people knew me for. And I just thought it was too indulgent. And then but I wish I had kept the part in where I made a decision that I could no longer celebrity bash, because it really was taking its toll on me. But, you know, the whole thing with Seinfeld is like, that's 20 years ago. And then on that show, on his show with my friend Bridget Everett, he goes off on me. And it reminded me of like a Western where I've given up gunslinging. And then Jerry comes to the town, the town in the middle of the town. And he's like, Goldthwait. And I'm like, I don't want to do this. You know, and he's Goldthwait. All right. So I take the 45s off the wall and I meet him in the town square.
Gunfight at the Friars Club Corral.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's this kind of famous moment in Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee where he talks about you to Bridget Everett, but your name is bleeped, which I think is very odd.
Yeah, that was really weird.
I don't know if he was worried about a legal thing there or why they decided to bleep your name.
I would almost guarantee that.
Well, I don't bleep anything. Well, I actually do bleep one thing, but
the weird thing, the creepy thing in that, not to keep putting attention on it, but his, to me, what I found unsettling as somebody who knows both parties, was his obvious delight in his guest's discomfort.
Yeah.
Making Bridget squirm, having
and
to kind of defend.
And laughing. I thought that was gross.
You know, I'm good friends with that's his best
I don't
friend.
Like him. At all.
Oh, no.
At all. In fact, I have a particular feeling about him. I had kind of forgotten about him.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a little article about him in the paper. Mm-hmm. And even in that, there was a veiled reference to his dislike of what I did.
Really?
Anyway, it didn't have my name, of course. He used to rail against comedians because they weren't as wild and dangerous as he was, because he sucked. Okay?
There's a really weird edit where it looks like an edit from a Dean Martin roast where he's saying all this horrible crap and then Bridget's laughing. It's like, if you look at it, because I looked at it because I was editing it, it's like, it's clearly that's, she's laughing at something else.
Oh, but, yeah.
But, you know.
She's in a different outfit.
Yeah.
She's on a beach.
But we should just call this movie cease and desist.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it'll be interesting for the legal ramifications. But the one thing that is bleeped is because I said he's, I talk about him banging teenagers, but that's not bleeped. But when I called him a Scientologist, which isn't true. He's not a Scientologist. He just went to Scientology meetings and thinks it's a really good thing for some people.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Especially for the people whose families were destroyed by it. He thinks it's really good.
Yeah, I was wondering, because I know, Dana, you said you know both parties, and obviously you were on Seinfeld, the show, and I assume you know him for a long time. What's your relationship with him?
Professionally courteous, and I haven't seen him probably since I was on the show. I mean,
do you think you'll be in the next season?
I don't know if he would even know who I was if he met me.
You're the Summer George.
I'm the Summer George. We used to, there's a coffee shop across the street from the Scientology Center, and they used to, you'd sit outside, and they used to come over. They don't do this anymore, and they would solicit you. And they would go, hey, can I ask you a question? And, you know, you could tell the outfit was pretty self-evident.
And there's that big blue building across the street.
Yeah. When we were young and ironic, we would go, yeah. And then we would, engage them for a couple minutes, and then we would go, you know what I need? I need a cult. I need a mind control cult. And then they would get up and storm off. Yeah. We wasted some of their time.
Reverse psychology.
Well, a Scientologist is supposed to rate a conversation, like our conversation. They're listening to this and they go, it's a 6, it's a 7, and then they're supposed to raise it a few points. That's the thing. So I worked with this woman who was a Scientologist, and she'd come in, she goes, how are you doing today, Bobcat? And I'd be like, you know what? I truly don't think I could become happier. I really feel so happy. And she would just short out because she couldn't raise this conversation.
No one's ever said that before.
Yep. I'm pretty sure that's why Tom Cruise jumps on that couch, because the crowd's already so excited.
Yeah. Well, his what more can he do? Yeah.
Yeah. So his job is to raise the level. So he jumped on the couch.
I have to say, I worked with Tom Cruise and he was delightful.
That's what everybody says.
He was delightful.
That's the word on the street. No one has a bad word to say about Tom Cruise.
He has to be.
Sure.
No, that's an old Barry Kervitz quote. When you would be like talking about somebody and he would go, you'd go, he's a nice guy. And Barry would be like, he has to be. He's not funny. I, on the other hand, can afford to be an asshole.
The one thing that's not in the documentary that I was curious about is, did you ever talk to Bridget Everett afterwards about what's going through her mind in that moment with Jerry?
She, the day it dropped, sent me a text going, hey, there was a really weird thing and I didn't think it was going to be on the show, but it is in the show. And I'm really, you know, and so she was squirming and I was like, hey, man, that's not on you. And, you know,
now it's material.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, I really don't hate the guy, because I don't, it's worse. I don't care about him. You know, I'm not like, oh, that, I don't wait. If you wake me up in the middle of the night and I go, Seinfeld. You
know? Who are these people?
I did think it was interesting. You know, I thought he and I were okay, believe it or not, because his manager's a really sweet guy and I see him a lot. And I probably was close to even like apologizing to him. And then he went crazy. So weird.
What did you feel like you had to apologize for?
For just signaling him out. You know, I mean, like, look, you know, when you go on a talk show and you write in a Sharpie on your T-shirt, kill Seinfeld, which I did do on NBC, you know, that's kind of a dick.
That's hard. That's a little harsh. Yeah.
That's a little harsh.
Why didn't you just go, you know, Craig Seinfeld? You know that guy.
I'm wondering if you guys could take turns kind of describing how you perceived each other's comedy when you were starting out, especially because now you're on stage together and you really have kind of converged in a way in terms of your styles. But I think you started out pretty different in terms of what you were trying to achieve on stage. So could you
That's a great
describe
question.
Each other's comedy as you perceived it at the beginning?
Well, Dana was always funny and he did really well, but he's the first to say it. And we even say it in the documentary, but he never stole material, but he would be influenced by other folks. So tonally, he would be like Jack Gallagher. Tonally, he'd be like Tom Kenny. So I had a problem with him. But if we really psychoanalyze this, you are what you hate. So if I'm getting upset because I'm seeing him being a little derivative of Tom Kenny, I think it's the part of me that's derivative of Tom Kenny. Tom Kenny's the funniest person I've ever met in my life, and I've known him since I was 6 years old. So there's probably parts of me that I didn't like in Dana, so I attacked him. But he was always funny. I actually talked to Tom Kenny last night and said that to him, and he said, I don't think you're anything like me. What are you talking about?
It could be more different.
Yeah. That's my relationship with Dana. And then I saw him change and find his own voice and go from being someone who I didn't think much of to being someone that I was slightly jealous of, which is the ultimate comedy compliment.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I just to give some background. When I started to do stand-up in Boston, I was 17, 18 years old. And emotionally, maturity-wise, I was probably closer to 13 or 14, just by nature of my weird upbringing and living in a very small town. And I really didn't know, is at the point where you're trying on personalities. Like, you go to a vintage clothing store and buy an Ike jacket and think, I'm this guy now. So yeah, what Bob said is really true, and it wasn't only on stage; it was in life. You know, I was just trying to unelegantly absorb a personality. So that's very, very true. As I sort of paraphrasing a joke from a really funny comedian named Kenny Rogerson, who said, you know, I meet people I knew before I was sober and I just apologize and walk away. That's Kenny's joke. And I say, I meet people I knew before I was 30 and I just apologize. That's true. And it was later as I knew who I was as a person and got into my early 20s, mid 20s, that I kind of outgrew that. And that's all true. What I always, there's two things about, you know, Bob. To me, the character that Bob did was always, it was a parody of stand-up comedy. Like, you know, this is the last guy on earth that should be doing stand-up comedy. And I can see how very dyed-in-the-wool traditional stand-up comedians would be offended and insulted by that. You know, Bob lived in Boston and he was friends with these guys, Dan Spencer and Tom Kenny, our friends. And then Bob moved to San Francisco, and then I moved onto the same street, and we became friends. And then Bob later said, yeah, I guess I was kind of jealous that you kind of stole my friends. And I was like, wait, I thought that's what it always was. It was something else.
It was much deeper. You know, it's funny. You know, I was shocked to find out that he was actually terrified of me. And when he divulged that, I felt horrible, but I also knew, oh, this will be great in the movie.
Do you feel like there's a big overlap between your fans? Is it, can you tell who's in the audience, who's sort of coming out for which one of you?
Yeah, I mean, my fans don't have sleeves.
Oh yeah, that's a good tell.
And Dana's fans start every question with,
actually.
Yeah, that's not every question, every sentence.
Yeah, every statement,
like,
yeah.
Actually, and it's so funny, like, after the show, you know, you can tell who's mine are a little bit more on the biker side.
You say at one point that that Trump supporters love Police Academy, and so that's had an impact on your career.
It did. They were really upset with me, which is always fine. You know, I like to thin out the herd if people think I'm going to, you know, double down on their backwards beliefs, you know, and I think there's some reason the persona, you know, all the way back to my first stand-up special, I'm doing material on the Iran-Contra hearings and I'm doing all this material, but I don't think people could see it. And also, if you're a comedy Nazi, you're not going to go, oh, well, he's got this persona, but he also has material. You're going to say, that's not how you do it. You know, you walk out and you tell people it's nice to be here and you know, you have your hot takes on dating.
The comedy Nazis terrorized Europe in the 40s.
Yeah.
Coming up, Bobcat and Dana open up about the harrowing car accident that nearly cost them their lives. And Bobcat reveals what his best friend Robin Williams was really like when the cameras stopped rolling.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. There are so many other great episodes to check out, including conversations with other iconic stand-up comedians like Sarah Silverman, Jim Gaffigan, Patton Oswalt, and more. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to those episodes and everything else from our free archive, and you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Bobcat Goldthwait and Dana Gould. You have this very, dramatic element of the movie that comes through because of this car accident that you were in. Can you tell the story about what happened? And
We were going to shoot the first night. We were pulling into the venue. We didn't wear our seatbelts. We could see the venue from our hotel, so it was like a 4 or 5 minute car ride, and we got T-boned. But that's all I could tell because I actually don't remember any of the accident, and I remember I kept asking if the dog was okay.
Yeah, and
I don't remember that. I was told that I kept asking if.
You kept asking about Emily, but the dog. It's
Bronx. Yeah,
saved my life. I was talking about this last night. We were literally four blocks from the venue, and so I walked up and I was going to get in the front seat, and the person who was driving the car, they had a little French bulldog that was sitting next to them in the passenger seat. And they went to move the dog, and I went, no, I don't care. And I just got in the back seat next to Bob. And then the door of the passenger seat 4 minutes later was concave.
It didn't exist. Yeah. So
yeah, I would have. And Brock was fine because he was the size of a ham, and he got thrown onto the floor.
But he just bounced around. Yeah.
Yeah. Had I been sitting in that chair, I would have been at best, profoundly injured.
It would have been, we would have turned into like Jan and Dean.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And so my low self-esteem saved my life by
by not insisting on the front
seat. By letting a dog take the good seat.
I love how you joke about the media coverage of the accident where it kind of like downplayed, downplayed both, sort of how famous you were and how serious the injuries were.
Yeah. Well, and then Kevin Hart blew us out of the headlines three days later.
Day. Oh, that's tough.
He had to have a better car accident.
But we were definitely, concussion and broken ribs. I had 3 broken ribs. Dana had 2 broken ribs. We were, but it's he and I being in an accident is like, how they'll say like a famous person and others.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was two others.
Yeah.
There was no.
They didn't know how to frame it. They were like, wait.
Yeah. There was no headliner. Yeah.
Anybody who remembers short attention span theater is reeling today.
I did wonder if it made you think at all about, things like legacy and how you'll be remembered and those kinds of things. Because I think it keeps coming up with anyone from, Robin Williams, who Bob, you obviously had a really close relationship with, to more recently Norm Macdonald, where this outpouring of love happens. And the thing that everyone always says is, well, they never got to see it. They never, they never got to experience it.
I don't think any, that kind of love that poured out for Robin, I don't think he would have ever been able to, one, let that in, and two, comprehend it. But I would say often I used to think about how would I be remembered, but it's changed since the accident. And I haven't told anyone this, including my partner, but since the accident, I do a thing where every day I go, you're going to die. And I don't do it in a negative way. I go, you're going to die. And it changes everything. It doesn't last, but whenever I think about that, it makes the day so much better.
Yeah, I do that too, but first I just dial a random number and then they pick it up.
Say, you're going to die. You're going to die.
I often wonder how I'll be remembered, and I think it will be with great effort.
I know that people were going to be like, I thought he was dead.
Yeah, I
know. Exactly.
That's not what you want to hear.
There was something like that recently. I forget who it was, but it was like, Irene Ryan has died. Like, what? She was alive? What the hell?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, Dick Van Dyke is still alive. My God. He's 1,000,006.
Yeah, Betty White.
I met Dick Van Dyke, and the whole time I was talking to him, I just wanted to blurt out, I was Bert and Mary Poppins in 8th grade, but I just kept it cool.
He would have loved that.
Yeah, he would have,
I think. You know what he did was... he goes, I saw this mime and he was terrible. And I go, did he talk? And then Dick Van Dyke laughed. He's like, oh, you're a comedian.
That's great.
It's pretty cool.
Dana, I have to tell you, I love your joke about Robin Williams. And Louis body dementia
Louis, yeah.
in this special.
I've noticed that I do talk about Robin sometimes, and I talk about him, and I feel weird if it becomes a bit, but I do like to talk about that he had this thing called Louis body dementia, so he didn't process.
Now, a lot of people think Louis body dementia is when you don't think you're jacking off in front of a woman against her will, but you are. This is a different kind.
Yeah. Hats off, buddy. You made me laugh.
But that was actually a genuine ad lib. And it threw me off. You see me? Because, like, I was even going to get darker at that point. I was going to talk about suicide and I was going to talk about all this other stuff. And then he said that, and I started laughing. And I mean, I still talk about it, but you know, you can't plan the times where you're going to leave it all out on stage. If you do, then it's not organic and it feels forced. And this movie, I don't think we got to that point where we're really out there bleeding on stage, but I do feel it's the most honest portrayal of what it's like to be on the road, where sometimes things land and you see the morphosis, you see like a bit become a bit, like when we go visit his mother in the hospital and then it turns into something on stage. Those things, I'm very happy about that, to get that, like the fact that we talk about something and then it ends up on stage and then it ends up getting polished and becoming a bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dana, do you remember where that joke just came to you in the moment?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, that just came. The best stuff always comes out of your mouth as you're doing it.
Like that bit where we just start riffing when that guy talks about the card dealer locally and we just go off on a serial killer card dealer and just becomes like a little minute or so of the special or movie, whatever this thing is. Those are the moments that I'm happy that are in there because they're not scripted. They're genuinely pretty well crafted and funny, I hope. And that's the stuff, the idea initially when I wanted to start shooting a whole bunch of shows. You know, what's interesting, I don't think people have picked up on is, it's like I knew I wouldn't be doing a giant multi-camera shoot. So I was like, and I wanted it to have the feel of a DIY, like a skating video. You know, that was really the idea.
And, mission accomplished.
Yeah, but I was like thinking, like, aesthetically, what could I do that with this small group that you don't see in a special? And it's interesting that no one's picked up on it, but because Dana and I have been doing this a million years and we're pretty unflappable, the camera is sometimes like a foot from our face. You know, and we told the audience that was going to happen and they were fine with it. So there's like shots that are more, without being a film twat, they're definitely, you know, they're more, it's more Lenny than anything, where there's these reverses and these, you know, yeah. These French.
Or even like sort of like concert films where they have the cameraman on stage and.
Yeah, just to have
Film Twat, one of the great cinema podcasts, by the way.
But it's, you know, the fact that there's like, I don't know many stand-up specials with French overs, so there we go. Yeah. All right, now I am officially a film twat.
It does
twat.
Look, it has a very organic feel, and it doesn't look or feel like a, you know, especially, it does really put you in a club, and it's, I'm really... Really, as just a guy that's in it, really proud to be in it, because that is what we're doing there is my view of the apex of what I can do as a stand-up. And it felt really great, you know, it felt really great and it did capture the sense of what it's like to be on the road in a way that's entertaining. And, you know, you do have real conversations in the car and it's not fake. I'm going to play a prank on Bob.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the,
I'm going to give him dengue fever, but he doesn't know it.
Well, but the thing was, is that I remember an interview with Robert Klein where he said, you know, I'm doing some of my best shows now and they're for a convention of dentists. And I feel like that's where Dana and I are at, where we're probably really coming to our stride, but but we're, you know, we're not on a sitcom. I'm 59 years old. I'm a cis white male, and I honestly feel my job, even though we made this movie, is to kind of shut up and get out of the way a little.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, totally.
You've done that as a director too, you know, filming other people's comedy and putting the spotlight on people whose comedy you like.
Yeah, and folks that I admire, I don't know if this works. I'm happy you liked it, but I know that normally when you watch a stand-up special, no matter who it is or how funny they are, there's always a fatigue that comes in at about 45 minutes. And I hope that by mixing it up with the autobiographical material and our relationship with each other and our relationship with show business, you know, it's like Dana imploded and I exploded. You know, I trashed my career. He trashed his brain and almost around the same time. And now we've come all the way through it. Right now we're the stay-at-home Wilburys.
Yeah, I mean, talking about
we're much older than the Wilburys were, really. Remember, we're making all those jokes about the traveling Wilburys, and then you look at them now, it's like, he was 42? God damn it!
And had already achieved so much.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody looked like Broderick Crawford at the time.
Well, this is concerts different because it's two guys who said, this is who we are, and we're not trying to make it. It's like, this is who we are.
Bob said, and it's really true, like, we couldn't have done this 10 years ago. I don't think we could have shared the stage 10 years ago.
Oh, no.
because of ego or?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Look at the name of this job is Look at Me. Don't look at him. Look at me.
Yeah. And a comedian's brain walks into a comedy club and goes, you know what this room needs? Me up there talking and no one else and everybody listening to me, you know?
Yeah. There's a real generosity with the going up together.
I'm monitoring an auction right now of a very rare photograph of a comedian in a conversation listening to the other person. There's only four of them.
Well, and this, you know, the thing that makes this different too is like we're not trying to top each other. We're teeing each other up, and sometimes we do top each other and stuff.
And I also think it's because we have other careers that I can do comedy by and large where I want, when I want, how I want. That's a beautiful luxury to have.
You know, it's funny because like I would remember, you know, once having a discussion with Robin where he was kind of on and we were in a restaurant and I was like kind of annoyed. I was like, you know, you couldn't be more loved as a comedian worldwide, not even just in America, worldwide. I don't know why you feel that you need these people in the restaurant to feel you're funny. And he's like, well, that's my neuroses. And mine is, I didn't care if people, like I would do a set and say really fucked up things or do really outrageous things on stage. And I wasn't really concerned with killing. I was more concerned that people go, I saw Bobcat Goldthwait last night. You know what he did? He cleaned a dead fish on stage and threw it in the audience, which I did.
Bobcat, you're weird.
And Robin and I, we started laughing. Your form, his form of neuroses is way more lucrative. You know?
It's interesting.
There's not a lot of money being the turd in the punch bowl.
The one time I ever met Robin, he was very much not on. And it was later when he was promoting that Broadway show that he did, the Bengal Tiger. And he was very, you know, kind of subdued and quiet. So maybe I wonder if it was later on he became less needing to be on all the time.
I feel like at that point, his Lewy body dementia was already kind of hitting him. And I feel that, you know, it was misdiagnosed as Parkinson's. And it was different when he was taking on jobs like that where he was obsessed with making sure he got his lines right and things like that. So he was already battling it, but, you know, hindsight, you know. And he didn't want people to know that he had what they had misdiagnosed as Parkinson's. But, you know, he got the... Yeah, I don't, whatever. So it's his story, but it's a shame. And like, he got really quiet, and I was witness to that too. And it would be really strange, because I knew he was seeing all these doctors, and I knew he was sober, and I knew he was doing all this. It was just strange that he started getting quiet.
Yeah. You know? You talk in the special about the curse of being your friend.
Well, Dana did. Yeah. Yeah. Because actually, he had a longer list of people who I know that.
So
that
it's Kurt Cobain is someone you knew, or I don't know, you know, how close you were, but.
We were friendly, you know. Mm-hmm.
What was the longer list that we didn't get in the film?
It was Kurt Cobain,
Barry Crimmins, Robin, David Bowie. You know, but
I'm in a bunker now.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Are you afraid for your life? Or are you? How are you?
But that's such
a.
But that is such a funny thing. And Dana, you know, that wasn't premeditated. Dana came up with that live on stage, and later on, I was like, oh, this is such a nice. Well, people have to see it, but you know, that's the kind of stuff we couldn't do as a solo act, obviously. And I think the two of us on stage listening to the other person, we're almost playing the audience, and the audience gets permission to go, hey, I think Dana went a little too far with this KKK bit. or is Bobcat really going to go talk about a plane full of folks with Down syndrome?
I love the part, again, not to get so super inside baseball, but I love the thing that really made me laugh is when I was talking about how repressed I am. I was talking about when I'm in a hotel room and I decide to masturbate, and Bob goes, "Wait, where am I in this?"
because he's miming and creating the whole world.
I love that too.
You know, when I was editing this together, it made me laugh. It's like I looked at my stand up for the first time ever. And I'm watching me, and I'm climbing up I'm climbing up a wall into a balcony, and I'm running around, and I'm doing all this stuff. And now I'm just sitting back, and Dana's doing all the physical stuff, and I turned into Dean.
Yeah, you know, you can just relax now.
I'm just sitting back. Yeah, I go, well, that's one way to do it, son.
Cut out, make.
Yeah.
Before we get to the end here, I want to do our segment called The First Laugh, where I ask you guys about some firsts in your career, and maybe if you can each give an answer, or if you don't have to have an answer for every one. But I would love to start with looking back, the first piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard growing up as a kid, if you remember.
Oh, I definitely was Abbott and Costello. Like, it, you know, but my home was an insane place. So, you know, my dad trying to jump the pool on a dirt bike, the above ground pool on a dirt bike, you know. So when I finally realized that he really wasn't going to do that stuff, it was pretty funny. But I watched Abbott and Costello a lot as a kid, and I realized that Lou Costello is a child, and I think that's why I thought he was funny. You know, I mean, you know, Martin and Lewis love each other, and Abbott and Costello are a very unhealthy relationship. It's a child. It's a child with a really abusive stepdad. That's basically the dynamics in there. But I used to really laugh watching them. But the first laughs I got, and I don't really actually think it's funny. But my sisters would always put me in skirts and dresses. And
yeah, it's an easy laugh as a kid.
Well, but I just never think it's funny even to this day. A guy in drag is not funny to me. But I also knew even as a little kid that if I didn't camp it up, if I just remained myself, it was a lot funnier. Like even as a little boy, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't
You're
do
doing
it.
Doing a deadpan kind of thing.
Yeah. I was just a dude in a dress, which I ran with all the way to my high school years. All right, Dana.
It's funny. So I think because again, like my childhood home was a lot like Bob's, except my dad wasn't fun at the time. But you know, there's a lot of like I remember watching like George Carlin would come on TV and the house would. Like, there were three things that would shut everybody up in the house, and it was you know, aside from a sports game, it'd be like George Carlin would be on TV, a Clint Eastwood movie would be on TV, or the Three Stooges would be on TV. And those are like the three things outside of the Red Sox that everybody would shut up and watch. The three things that I remember as a very little kid was Don Knotts on the Andy Griffith Show, Tim Conway on the Carol Burnett Show, and Lou Costello in Abbott and Costello Meets Frankenstein. Specifically, when Dracula's coming out of his costume and he's going, like that is just classic. And then, you know, both of us came of age when the original SNL took off, and that was such a huge formative experience for me. It's so weird. I'm now very good friends with Lorraine Newman, in fact, the other night we went to the Griffith Park Haunted Hayride together.
Oh, and that sounds
and
fun.
It was great. It was great. Lorraine's the best. But it's very strange to me to be hanging out with Lorraine Newman.
It's I can like, imagine.
But you for me, know. It's like when I was a kid, there was like, you know, the guys who liked Farrah Fawcett and all that crap, Cheryl Ladd, you know. And for me, it was Lorraine Newman and Gilda Radner. They were so, so hot.
Yeah. They're funny.
Yeah, because they were funny. They were funny. Yeah. Do you each
Melanie
remember
Chardoff too?
Do you each remember the first joke that you told that really worked, that really connected to an audience, first joke or bit that you kind of could go back to and that you felt like, oh, I can do this?
Well, I was probably like I was on Bozo in Syracuse, which so it wasn't the Bozo, it was like a farmed out
Bozo. It was
Bozo.
A Bozo.
yeah. And I told a joke on the show and I would have got a laugh, but some kid peed during my bit. I guess it got a laugh, but it wasn't.
Do you remember the joke?
Yeah, it was something about a riddle about a guy leaves on Sunday and a horse on Sunday and then comes back 10 days later on Sunday. How did that happen? And then Bozo, because he's an idiot, didn't get it. And I go, Sunday was the name of the horse. But during that, I look over and this kid had made some art for Bozo out of a pie tin. And the kid's, another kid's peeing on the, and you're ding, 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 ding. So I'm trying to tell the joke and I'm like,
how do you compete with that? Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, the kids are all dying. So I thought I was killing, but I learned work blue. That's what I learned that day on Bozo.
I have two brief stories. One, I lived in a very, very small little mill town in Massachusetts, and I knew everybody. Like I didn't, you know, I grew up, I didn't really meet people I didn't know until I went to college. And I was known to be funny, and I was a lector at church. And, you know, you go up before the mass and you're like a reading from the book of Isaiah or whatever. And I would do it and people would laugh. And the more serious I would try to be, the more they would laugh because I was just like known to be funny. And at one point, Father Riga pulled me in and said, it's just not working. I got fired by the Catholic Church.
That's tough.
So, but I remember the first time I did stand up at the Ding Ho.
That was the first time comedy saved Dana.
It really was. I had a joke that to this day I think like that was a good professional quality joke. And this is June of 1982. I was 17, and it was I was Roman Catholic. You know, Roman Catholic Church, they turn the wine to blood, but that doesn't work at the beach. You can't be drinking on the beach and have the cop go, "Hey, ditch the wine. I'm sorry, it's the blood of Christ." What about the 2 6-packs? I'd like you to meet the 12 apostles. That's a professional joke.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
17 years old.
I would say my first joke, and I was probably 13 or 14, was I lost my job. That joke. I lost my job. Well, I didn't really lose it. I know where it is still. Just when I go there, there's this new guy doing it. And then I would do a callback at the end of the set, and I'd say, I lost my girlfriend. Well, I didn't really lose her. I know where she is. Just when I go there, there's a new guy doing it. So, and I would do that in the persona. So.
Yeah. Which you could imagine. We can all imagine what that would have sounded like.
Or maybe not. You might have some Gen Zs that don't know who Grandpa and Grandpa are.
I don't know. Yeah, we'll see.
We like to think of ourselves as the Bartles and James of alternative comedy.
The alternative comedy sunshine boys.
Statler and Waldorf of alt comedy.
Dana, do you remember the first joke that you got on The Simpsons?
Yes, I do. In fact, somebody was at our house and quoted it as one of their favorite jokes. And I went, I wrote that joke. That was my first joke. and I will balance it by my favorite joke in an episode that I wrote that I not only did I not write it, I don't know who did write it, but there was an episode called Homer the Drudge, where it was Homer started the gossip website and then ended up being sent to the island from the prisoner. You know, again, we're hewing down the mainstream. And like in The Prisoner, he tries to escape and they send giant white balls after him, like in the British show The Prisoner. And Homer takes out a pin and pops the balloon. And then they cut back to the security base. And the guy goes, why do we use balloons as security? And then my joke was, shut up, that's why. And that was that took about, and then, by the way, the room was at a dead halt for about 45 minutes.
How to get past that point, yeah.
Yeah, and so that was pretty great. I love those very simple, beautiful jokes George Meyer wrote a lot of the great Ralph Wiggum, like My Cat's Breath Smells Like Cat Food. This is a George Meyer one. I had one for Ralph Wiggum where he went into the adults only section of the comic book store and you just hear him say, everybody's hugging.
I remember that one. there was one that in an episode that you wrote that you didn't write the joke.
I wrote an episode called Papa's Got a Brand New Badge where Homer started the home security system. And basically all the episodes I wrote, you could see where I was in my life at the time that I wrote the episode. I bought a house, had a baby, they're doing a commercial for the home security system. And this old woman is sitting alone and these Maurice Sendak-like monsters come into her house. And she goes, help, monster! And then Homer comes out, you're safe with Spring Shield. And then he gives the monster his card and the monster takes the card and just goes, monster put in wallet. And he takes out a wallet. But there's a wait, so it's a real monster and he's in the commercial? Does the monster know it's a commercial? I'm pretty sure that joke was written by the great Tom Gamble, but I'm not 100%. It's in my episode and it ain't mine. But it's my favorite joke.
So finally, just to give a shout out to comedy, something that's making you laugh right now, can you each highlight something that's really making you laugh right now, the last piece of comedy that really made you laugh?
Oh, that's a great question. That's current?
or it might not be current, but you may have watched it recently.
I'm a big fan. Yeah, well, there's a lot of comedians that I'm friends with. And I'm a big fan of Sam Morrell, who's just...
Yeah, he's been on this podcast. He's fantastic.
He's the best. Hannah Einbinder, super, super funny.
Megan Keister, my friend James Fritz. I mean, these are people that I watch and that I'm amazed by. But, you know, I'm not that edgy, you know. Ted Lasso, that does it for me.
That's a shocker right there. Bobcat Goldthwait loves Ted Lasso. I feel like it's
I think it proves how
everyone loves that show.
Yeah, but I don't think I'm that. You know, I it's hopeful, and I don't see where it's going. So that's great. I think that's a really hard write something like that.
I do that. Yeah, and I like the idea that it is not so acerbic. Bob did it too. I have a little show on YouTube called Hanging with Dr. Z, which is basically like a lot of people do. They'll get to a point in your career where you make a talk show with Dr. Zayas. But we found very early that whenever it was acerbic and sort of stinging, it didn't work. It's very Sammy Davis Jr. It's super dumb and super silly and super kind-hearted. And I think that that's the only way it works. And that's a nice relief. And that's coming from, and you know, two people that are like, people go, oh, you're so dark. I'm like,
yeah, I mean, people always think of me as dark and I don't
see it. Both of us get it. I was like, yeah, exactly. I don't get it.
Then never mind. I don't think I'm dark. And then there's... Never mind.
Then the next thing that comes into your head is...
Well, it was like I took Barry Crimmins to be cremated, you know, when he was dead. I didn't do it.
Yeah, not when he was alive.
Not prematurely. And the guy goes, do you want to push the button on the crematorium? And I go, I'm not mad at him. So the fact that, you know, the fact that cracking wise at this moment, but that's always been a defense in my whole family and stuff, you know, that you always make sure. But I felt like, you know, the world is so dark, and the most contrarian thing I could do at this moment was I wrote like a kid's movie. That's the last thing I did. I wrote like a G-rated film, because to me, to write a hopeful movie during these times felt very, that was the challenge, you know, can you, and every time I make a movie, it's always like, can you, and Joyride, the can you was, can you make a narrative and entertain people? And can you even be in it and make a thing that people enjoy? So I hope people like it.
Yeah, well, I really loved the movie, and I think people will really enjoy it. And
it was nice to see you again.
Yeah, thanks guys, this was really fun.
Thank you.
Oh man, thank you so much to Bobcat Goldthwait and Dana Gould for that super fun conversation. Please do yourself a favor and stream Joyride on Apple TV, Google Play, or wherever you can rent and buy movies online. We'll put a link to view it in the description for this episode as well. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next week on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.